You're listening to the Electric Sheep Cinema Podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and this month's show is a special early Halloween edition looking at two new interesting low-budget movies which offer innovative and unconventional approaches to the zombie genre. Opening in cinemas today is the low-budget Canadian film Pontypool, and later in the show I'll be talking to the producer of that movie. However, before that, I'm talking to Mark Price, the director of the supposed £45 zombie movie Colin, which opens in cinemas on the 23rd of October. I'm talking to Mark Price, the director of Colin. The screening that we've had at Frightfest, is that the world premiere then?
No, it has screened at a couple of other festivals. I mean, we fell in with our sales agent when we screened at the Abattoir Festival, which is the only Welsh horror festival in Aberystwyth, and it's called Abattoir, and it's spelt in that way, where Aberystwyth, Abattoir, it's funny.
So you've had a couple of audience reactions to the film so far. Have you sat in on both of the screenings?
I've seen the film with a couple of audiences, and the reactions are really nice, but I think at some point they just sort of started getting very nervous and very... So it's actually quite scary experience for me to sit in and watch it with an audience now. So I haven't seen it. I've also been doing a lot of work on the DVD this weekend, so I haven't been able to sit in and watch it with... I couldn't watch Fridays, and we're doing interviews with random people, so I haven't had a chance to sit in there yet. But apparently the responses went very well. We had people in there on Friday, and they were really excited at how well it was received, and... Hopefully we're having a similar thing today. Wouldn't it be terrible if, like, the Friday guys were great, so we're all confident, and then today they just hate it. So it'd be terrible.
Well, at least the screening today, everyone will be dressed as zombies. So, you know,
that's
there's the
right,
buzz.
Yeah. So there's, yeah, that's cool, that's cool. People might think that has something to do with us.
I guess the low budget of the film is a double-edged sword, because a lot of the pre-publicity has been about how little it cost, how you got the actors through Facebook and so on, but watching Colin, actually I thought it was a very good film.
Now I'm nervous.
And so I think it's, I hope that as pre-publicity continues to the film and it gets a proper release, then there will be a mention of actually it is a, you know, it's a very solid zombie film.
Yeah, that's what we were hoping. I mean, the good thing about that press is that it's a platform for us to talk about what we wanted to do with the characters and the heart of the story and how we went about making it and what we really wanted to do. But, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think it's the sort of thing that, you know, once the film is released, it will probably just go away fairly quickly. I mean, even though it's all going to be all over the DVD covers and whatnot, I think once people see it, they'll either be like, yeah, this looks like a cheap movie, who cares? Or they'll like it. No, so I think that's hopefully where we'll be with it. That is more important, because we always hope that the quality of the story and would be the selling point. People just saying, oh, it's 45 pound movie, it doesn't look that great, and it's not that great either. I mean, if that was the case, I think, yeah, we'd be in trouble now at the screening. We'd be coming up, people would be like throwing stuff at us, which might still happen. But it hasn't yet, so fingers crossed.
And not only that, at this year's Fright Fest, there are a lot of zombie films showing. I think there's 6 or 7. And out of the ones I've seen so far, I've seen Dead Snow, where the gimmick is it's Nazi zombies, and I've seen Infestation, where the gimmick is it's half zombie, half giant spider people. But I know. But the two that have impressed me the most, in fact, out of all the films in general at the festival, are your film and Pontypool. And I think maybe it's because when you have a very low budget, if you want a film to actually attract attention, you actually have to really work on the script and, you know, and the actors.
Yeah. I think it should be. I mean, I was raised on blockbuster movies in Swansea, and their films are very close to me, you know, and that I feel a lot of fondness for. And I think that always should be, regardless of the film, that should always be the most important thing. All the amazing advances in digital technology, they're just tools to tell your story. And although we weren't in a position to embrace any advances in digital technology, we did embrace quite a lot, which was the ability to make. To make a movie in your own home, in your bedroom, on an old wrecked PC, and still being able to fumble through it and get it done. That was always the most important thing. And with Colin in particular, I mean, I'm a zombie fan. I wanted to do a zombie movie, but I also wanted to do something that I could be confident hadn't really been done before. And obviously missing that there was a movie called iZombie, we dove into Colin and got very excited about making this film the way we wanted to make it. I honestly think that if I knew about iZombie beforehand, I probably wouldn't have made it. But
I think iZombie is probably obscure enough that you don't have to be worried about people seeing it.
Yeah, and it's a very different movie as well, apparently. I haven't seen it myself, but it's but Andrew Parkinson, the director, he sort of sent me a copy of it, and he's a really nice guy. And his film is more of a slow transformation from a man into a zombie. So by the end of the movie, he becomes a zombie. So more akin to The Fly, I guess. And we just kind of skim over that pretty quickly in the first 10, 15 minutes of our movie. Just crack on with the zombie part.
I thought it was really interesting, the structure of the film, that the origin of Colin becoming a zombie, you leave right until the end. What sort of motivated that decision?
I think it was definitely the idea of rewarding an audience with information that is that for me would have been interesting to get back. And I know that in some cases, giving away a backstory isn't necessarily the best way to develop character. But for us, it certainly felt like more of a payoff. And I mean, I was talking about what the original ending was, and we were doing it recently for the DVD, and how it evolved as we shot. So, I mean, we always knew where the movie was going to end. But how do we draw attention to certain objects, items? That was the challenge, and to try and do it in a way that was engaging for an audience as well. So, yeah, that was always really exciting. And the danger, though, of doing that is if you look at a movie that's, say, shot on 35mm with a budget like Chinatown or Hot Fuzz, when the twist sort of comes at the end and you realise that everything you've been watching means nothing, you sort of go, oh, well, that's okay. Oh, this is a good twist. But what gets you through that is you've got a character trying to find something out. So the audience is with him trying to find something out. When you've got a character that isn't actually motivated in any clear direction, and because of the format that we shot the movie on, this low-budget format, there's a very real danger that we look like we don't know how to tell a story, we don't know how to edit a scene. And so, you know, we could lose a lot of our audience along the way. So it's kind of scary for us to have it all rely on that last 10, 15 minutes. But we certainly wanted that to be a rewarding experience for the audience, so that was it. It was we decided to do it anyway, regardless of people storming up and discussing what the hell is this mess all about.
What kind of camera did you shoot it on? Because it does look, it is a very kind of sharp, clear image, but obviously not HD.
Yeah, it's we shot on two camcorders. One was a three chip camcorder, both Panasonics. I'm afraid I forget the model, and the other one was a single chip camera because the three chip died about halfway through, so we had to use the single chip camera because we were grading it the other way. See, this is the little trick to it, that because you can't get the quality of these cameras to look like 35mm. So if we were to try and make it look like 35mm and light it very clean, then it would just look cheap because it's not 35mm, but it's lit like 35mm. So what we did, we went the other way. We really embraced the flaws in the technology. So we had lots of hot spots and dark shadows, and I think that sort of lends something to the visual quality of the film. And so that was what we did, really. I mean, in terms of the crowd scene, say, when you looked at the film and broke it down, as complicated as it seems, this whole film about the end of the world, it's actually about one guy whilst the end of the world is going on around him, and that makes it feel so much bigger. Because I think as an audience, if we were going to experience the end of the world, we wouldn't be sitting alongside the president, like, well, what's your next decision? We'd be sitting here, the whole thing, we'd totally be beyond our control, and we'd just be caught up in it. And there's something about that I kind of think that an audience can relate to. So that was the idea, to show it in that way. And sorry, I'm rambling on at tangents. I've actually kind of forgot, but there was a point there somewhere.
No, I was just asking about the camera, because obviously, you know, there's loads of talk about how everything's going to be shot in HD now. But the thing is, someone like Michael Mann, for example, has shot his last three films on what looks like a standard definition camera because he likes the aesthetic of it. Yeah. So I don't think you necessarily have to use the new technology as long as you know what you're doing in terms of filmmaking.
Yeah. Mike Figger says the exact same thing. He's got this fantastic book called Digital Filmmaking. And what he says in that book is that, you know, old technology isn't useless just because new technology has replaced it. If you look at a film like, now he doesn't say this particularly, but if you do look at a film like The Blair Witch Project, the camcorder that was used in that movie, your mobile phone probably has a better resolution than that camera, but that film was screened in a cinema. I think we're just in a situation where you don't want to cast aside old technologies because new technologies come along. That's kind of a habit that I think kind of creeps into filmmaking, which is fair enough if you've got big budgets, but for some reason that stuff sort of creeps into low-budget filmmaking, and it kind of confuses me because it's very irrelevant in terms of storytelling. It just needs to be about the story and the character. That's all a low-budget filmmaker needs to worry about. If I knew as much about cameras as the cameramen have been meeting recently, I would have gone, oh, we'll never be able to make a movie like this. Let's not bother. And we wouldn't have made it. So, I mean, sometimes a little ignorance can be a good thing. And this idea that you need to spend all this money on technology, HD cameras, it's really not the case. It's a problem for us because when we're screening on a cinema screen, our movie doesn't look as great as it does on a television. But still, you know, we didn't have this thing graded properly. I was doing it in my bedroom.
And presumably it's getting a relatively wide cinema release next month.
I think it's quite a limited release, but it's a cinema release nevertheless, and I think that's something that I really hope. There's a 14-year-old kid sitting in his or her bedroom lamenting the fact that they'll never be able to make their movies because they don't have any money, and they'll hear about this asshole with his £45 zombie movie and go, well, wow, I've got my phone's better quality than his camcorder, so let's... I'm going to make my movie. I'm going to have a go. I'm going to make a film. And that would be amazing to me. That would be the best thing that could happen at the Collins, that like, other people will just make movies and realize that technology isn't an obstacle that's going to stop them. It's something that they can embrace and use to their advantage.
But worst case technology, if the film hadn't been picked up by a distributor, what was your kind of like, you know, scenario that would have at least made you happy in terms of, you know, showing the film to other people?
We just planning to send it out to horror websites and horror festivals and hoping that we'd have some sort of, you know, people would see it and say, hey, I saw this zombie movie, it was okay, you know, you should check it out if you get a chance, and use the quality of the film as a calling card, because it is one thing that really I kind of despise. It's the idea that, oh, I want to break into filmmaking, so what'll I do? I know, I'll just make a crappy genre film just to get a foot in the door. I mean, that really bothers me, because, you know, the genre film is something that means a lot to a lot of people, myself particularly, and I can't think of anything more offensive than someone wasting money and making a terrible film, where there are a lot of filmmakers out there, if they had half the budget of those movies, they could make something really special that would really make a difference. So I'm not saying I could, I'm just saying it's still a waste.
Well, I'm not saying that you don't deserve to get a decent budget for your next project, whatever that might be. But when you see low-budget filmmakers who then immediately get given a big budget for their next film, quite often it completely falls apart, like, you know, the Blair Witch people. So, I mean, what would your ideal scenario be for your next project?
Well, the idea for our next one is to keep the budget very low, so low that we still retain a level of control. And that's the big thing. I think if someone was to say, here's $3 million, make whatever movie you want, we haven't earned our stripes yet. We know the person giving us that $3 million isn't going to be confident that we know what we're doing. And I can understand why there'd be a level of paranoia and why whoever's, you know, funding that would step in and say, look, we're not entirely sure. You should do it like this. Play it safe. Do this. And that doesn't necessarily make for an interesting movie. For our next film, we're still looking at a very modest budget, but we want the film to look like it's cost $3 million. So we're trying to find ways to be able to do that, which is a challenge. But at the same time, I think movie making is problem solving. Whether your movie costs $70 million or whether it costs £70, it's problem solving, and nothing will change that. The best thing I think we can hang on to is the team of problem solvers that we had working on Colin, make sure we're all working together on the next film. And there are elements of the next film that seem fairly easy, and there are elements that seem beyond our reach. But that's the excitement there. That's what it was like for Colin. When we started this, I knew nothing about makeup design. And now I can make a zombie. I mean, our makeup guys showed us how to make zombies so that they wouldn't necessarily have to be around all the time. And they brought the equipment and left it with us so we could actually do it. So it's,
in the publicity materials for the film, it says that you found the actors on Facebook. Was it the same for a lot of the crew as well?
That's something I kind of got a bit out of hand, actually. We used Facebook to communicate with everyone, say, on Sunday we're shooting this, who can come? We didn't really find many people on Facebook. I mean, Alistair had known for a while. There are other actors. I met through Alistair and other actors. And we had, I think, two auditions. One was for the girls in the basement scene, because that was such a technically complicated scene. It was the first one we kind of worked on. And the other one then was just, there was a point where I thought Al didn't want to do it. So I put out a casting call looking for like zombies in general. But, you know, there was a chance one could be Colin. And he got in touch and was like, dude, what the fuck? I was like, you don't want to do it though, are you? Because I never said that. I was like, oh, great, let's meet up. And then we talked about it and he took it. So he let me film it for 18 months. But yeah, it was, that was basically it for most of the people who we got along with at the auditions, because that was what we were always really looking for, were people who we could interact with and there'd be a degree of banter. It was never a case of we didn't want any egos on the film, because it's low budget, you can't, there's no place for them, you know. It's so yeah, and it was such a harmonious experience. I mean, if luck comes in quotas, I'm fucked, because I'm in serious trouble, because yeah, we used it all up on this film. The next one's going to be a disaster.
I hope not. In terms of the locations for the film, it doesn't actually look that British. It has more of an international feel. Oh. For example, the scene with the hoodies, for want of a better
the
word.
The stacked terraces.
I mean, that, I think I saw a similar scene in an Italian gangster movie recently. Oh. You know, so it feels much more European than British. Was it just that you looked for interesting locations and you didn't have a particular aesthetic in mind?
It was. We were definitely looking for that places that had that sense of isolation. Now, Rolly Way there, one of my students, I was teaching sort of low budget filmmaking techniques at Kilburn Park, and one of my students said, "You got to see this place, Rolly Way. It's just off Abbey Road. It's fantastic, above ground and underground." And what it allowed us to do visually was to really breathe and just have that sense of depth. And it felt so irregular to be able to do that, that actually I still look at the film, and every single time I see those scenes, I'm waiting for someone to just walk out of a door and just blow a take that I missed this entire time. But
so you didn't leaflet everyone and say, "Please stay in your homes between the following hours"?
No, I think the students was telling me that Rolly Way is quite dangerous and we shouldn't go down there without them. And it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I guess everyone was still in bed. So, but everything else there, I mean, the tower blocks, which are just around the corner, just the visually so striking for me. And yeah, I've got a lot of fondness for those places, and definitely want them incorporated in the film. Even though if you actually look at the locations, if you knew the area where we shot the film, where Colin's house is and the house he ends up at the end, he could have just come out, gone down there, and there he is. He's there. It's just like a 2-minute walk, but he gets there via Kilburn Park. He's a zombie, isn't he? Anyway. His sister even brings him back at one point, and he ends up somewhere else. He ends up in Teddington.
Well, there are far worse sins against geography in cinema. I think one of the worst is the live-action version of 101 Dalmatians, which makes no sense whatsoever.
I'm from Swansea, so when Twin Town came out, the biggest thing you had in Swansea, you ever going, "Oh, but this doesn't work. Like, I just went around the corner there, and now they're 2 miles away. It's confusing." And I was there with them going, "Aye, but yeah, it's very confusing." But funnily enough, I learned a lot about sort of spatial continuity. And then for the majority of the audience, you can get away with quite a lot. And my kids at Kilburn Park, the kids I teach there, they're the ones that will be coming down to me hard saying, "Hey, you're in Rolly Way, now you're back into it. What the hell?" You know, I'm like, "Oh, look, you're okay." But they haven't given me too much grief yet.
What has been their reaction to the film show so far? Or haven't they seen a complete cut yet?
They've seen it, yeah, and they were amazingly sort of responsive and very positive to it, which is one of those things where you send the DVD to them, and they're brilliant in that their communication can sometimes be a little bit slack. So I'm sitting there the whole time going, "Yeah, they hate it, and they're just not saying anything because, we're friends." And then you'll get together with them and they'll go, "Hey, how are you doing?" And they're like, "Oh, dude, really liked it." I was like, "Oh, really? Oh, that's such a relief." So the response has been great from all of them. And it's just, I mean, the scene with the hoodie guys, they're not actors. They're just giving it a go. One of them at the time was auditioning again to RADA. The other one was just giving it his best shot. The next day, he cracked me up. He's like, "Man, I think I'm the best zombie in your film." I was like, "You weren't a zombie, you were a human." He's like, "Was I? Oh, whatever." And they were up against two Lambda students, Daisy and Alistair. And Tat was a very experienced television actor. So it was really amazing just to see these two guys thriving amongst these actors, holding their own, And the guy with the samurai sword, he was just coming out and giving it a go. He's just a really good guy. He was the guy that found the location.
Cool.
And he said, "I can get a samurai sword if you want." I was like, "Is it sharp?" He went, "No." And I went, "Okay, cool, go get it."
No one lost any limbs in the making of this movie.
No, we were okay. But it was quite scary running around waving a sword at people, sort of going, "Ah, I'm going to cut your head off." It's a scary place to be.
Well, and I suppose in a low-budget film like that, one of the most scary sort of applications of budget and training must be actually things like the fight scenes where people are being beaten up so no one actually gets hurt.
Yeah. I mean, that in a way explains how the frenetic camera worked, because if you were to see that, smoothly gliding along, you'd see that aside from the two actors we had placed to throw proper hits that would register properly on camera, everyone else is sort of like sort of awkwardly grappling. And that's we got some fun with that on the documentary and the DVD. You really get to see some of these guys just like being quite lame, but it's really funny. But of course, in the film, because the camera work, I mean, it becomes a character, and we wanted to generate a level of intensity. And the idea was we'd have two camera styles there's a dominant human force or human perspective in the scene, then it would be quite panicky and frantic and handheld. But for the zombies' perspective, when it was relatively calm and quiet, it would either be locked off or on these rickety plastic tracks that we managed to find. So,
I mean, I probably shouldn't ask you this because the film should stand on its own, but the way that I read the sort of final scenes was that when Colin comes home, it almost starts awakening memories in him. That was your intent, or do zombies not have human thoughts?
Well, one of the things we wanted to put in the film, we wanted the audience to ask themselves questions. Yeah. So there are certain elements that I don't want to, you know, address. I want to leave people to come up with their own decisions. The basement scene is a really interesting one. Some of the stuff I've heard back from that, what people think is going on there, and it's like, you're a sick, sick man, Mr. Price. They're like, whoa, look, we don't clearly state that. That's what you know, you're the one that came up with that. Yeah. You know, and so it's kind of a lot of fun to hear people, you know, give their own thoughts on it. But no, I don't think it's my place to tell anyone what it was. The film, you're right. I think the film should sort of speak for itself. And I wouldn't want to, you know, acknowledge that you're absolutely correct or rob you of a thoughtful analysis. It's just not the place of the filmmaker to do that. That's the one downside to DVD. You think certain filmmakers are geniuses, and then you hear them talking about their stuff, and you go, oh. Man, Brett Ratner isn't a genius. Oh, that was a bit harsh. I feel like a jerk now.
It's absolutely fine. I think that's a good place to leave it.
Ratner's going to come and get me.
Next, you'll hear my interview with the producer of the new Canadian horror film Pontypool, which opens in cinemas today.
I'm talking to Jeffrey Coughlan, the producer of Pontypool. What's your background in the film industry? Because this seems a very kind of adventurous project. While it's in some ways a simple concept, you know, a radio station keeps broadcasting during a zombie outbreak, although they're probably not zombies, they're whatever you want to call them, infected, mutant, rage, people. Right. Crazy people. It's in some ways also quite a hard sell, because the reason why they become crazy is almost like a hard sci-fi idea. And yes. So I guess it's treading that sort of middle ground between not alienating the audience but also having to make them think for themselves.
Yes. Actually, we've gotten that comparison quite a lot, though, too. You know, sort of a Twilight Zone type of feel, you know, meets Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. You know, it is really clever. It's the first feature I've done. Been doing a lot of television back in Canada and whatnot, though, too, and been looking for a script for a while. Read a lot of stuff that was attached to a project with George Romero for a little while, though, too, that just wasn't going to come to fruition, though. We weren't going to be able to move it on the schedule we wanted, and literally ran into the director of Pontypool, Bruce McDonald, who's quite an icon in Canada, and just one night at a bar. And over a drink and a cigarette, though, he asked him, so what do you got cooking? What are you doing? He says, well, you know, we just finished this little script called Pontypool. It's a horror thing. And Bruce has never done a horror film before, though, too. He did a film last year called The Tracy Fragments. It starred Ellen Page, who, you know, was nominated for an Oscar for Juno and whatnot, though. And a lot of rock and roll mockumentary-type movies like Hardcore Logo and Roadkill and so forth. So I immediately stopped and was like, you want to do a horror film? I said, all right, what do you think the budget is? And he says, well, we can do it really cheap, you know, maybe $400,000. And I said, well, Bruce, I can do that, you know? I said, and if you want to do horror, then I want to be involved. So send me the script. So the next day he sent the script. But before I'd even received it, I called my producing partner, Ambrose Roche. I called him and said, Ambrose, I ran into Bruce last night, the two. He wants to do a horror movie. And Ambrose was like, oh, my God, really? I said, yeah. He said, what's it called? I said, Ponytail or something. I have no idea, but we're doing it. And sure enough, we got the script later that day, though, read it right away, optioned it, and 3 months later, we were shooting. And the thing that really drew me to this project, though, too, which I thought was really clever, and again, I've read, you know, I can't even tell you how many hundreds of scripts I've read, though, too, looking for something to really strike a chord. And also, as a producer, you're looking for something that you know you're actually capable of being able to produce, you know, that you can raise the right amount of money for. I mean, somebody can bring me a script, you know, for a $25 million movie, and you know what? I'm not going to get that money. No one's going to give me $25 million. So, you know, with Pontypool, which was $1.5 million, it's like, you know what? That was our actual budget. It wasn't 400,000 as Bruce thought. I could certainly do that. And the thing that really drew me to it was the uniqueness that, okay, great. Being trapped in this confined space meant that we weren't going to be going outside so much, though. And it was really all of what you don't see that really played up the fear in this, though. Much like the Blair Witch Project does, for example. I mean, you never really see anything except, you know, the dark woods, you know, and little placements of rocks here and there, though. It's all these things, though. It's the performance that really, you know, scares the shit out of you. And certainly Stephen McHattie in Pontypool, you know, is he makes this movie work. You know? And as does Rick Roberts, as Ken Loney in The Sunshine Chopper, you know, his without him, you know, this movie really sort of falls apart because he is the vision of everything scary about this movie.
When you say that Bruce basically brought you the script, normally, I guess a producer or an executive producer options a novel and then finds a director. Does this kind of happen the other way around? Did he meet the guy who wrote the novel and said, I'd like to turn this into a movie?
Yeah, Bruce had actually, the novel's about 10 years old, and Bruce actually optioned the novel, like, as soon as it was published. It's a Canadian writer again, Tony Burgess. He optioned it for a Kinder Easter egg. A handshake deal and a chocolate egg. That was the original deal. Of course, we obviously got screwed because we paid a dollar for the option when we did it, but... Yeah, he had read the book, and he'd been trying to make this project for about 10 years, though, in different incarnations, though. Yeah. It's actually, the novel itself is a much bigger idea, you know, and that was the movie they were trying to make. And it just, they never got a script to the right place, though. There were other producers attached throughout time and whatnot, though. And then what happened is CBC Radio in Canada approached Bruce McDonald about doing a one-hour radio drama and said, you know, do you have any ideas for something? And Bruce sat back and thought, you know what, maybe we could do Pontypool as, you know, a little one-hour radio drama. So the idea was sort of reborn out of that, obviously bringing it in a lot more, though, and then that's where the idea for the feature script came. And we made the movie before the radio play was done, though, too. They actually took the soundtrack from the film to produce the radio play and then re-recorded some additional stuff to sort of tighten it up, though. So, and it's available, CBC Radio, BBC Radio here in the UK has played it as part of their wordplay competition, a radio drama competition. So, yeah, so that's sort of the incarnation of the script itself and how it came about. But, yeah, normally, you're right, the producer does go and option the book or, you know, finds a spec script, as we call them, you know, where a writer has written it without an advance for money, and you option that, and again, you start knocking on doors trying to find as much money as you can.
Because, like I said, it's not that difficult a concept in some respects to latch onto, the fact that, you know, it's a radio station reporting on an outbreak of nutters in the local community. So to people who don't have to be told the full complexities of the story, you could almost say it's like The Fog and we just stay with Adrian Barbeau for the entire movie. but at the same time, I mean, you know, kind of like steeped in North American mythology is the idea of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast, for example. And this is like the flip side of that, that there actually is a horrible catastrophe happening that has some sort of supernatural scientific origin. And possibly the people listening to the radio station don't believe it. So you're there with the newscaster as they're dealing with the situation. I mean, it is actually a very interesting idea to do on film.
Yeah, it's... the actors really make this story work, though, too. It is a simple concept, though, and we were very lucky. And I mean, we went through many revisions of the script, though, too, before we finally got to a point where we were ready to shoot. And that, again, all happened in a very short time. But there were a lot of things and ideas that we played with and stuff that we knew we had to get rid of because it just didn't work, you know? In fact, there were a lot of exterior stuff that was shot. And it was in post-production in the editing room that we realized, you know what, this doesn't work. We're actually cutting some of the tension out of there. And the fact that these guys are trapped in that radio station, though, too, and not being able to see with their own eyes sort of what's happening lends itself to a really sarcastic sort of dark sense of humor as well, though, too, a comedy, which really comes through in those performances, though, too, because you have to be able to laugh. The idea that, as it turns out, you know, it's the English language that is infected with the virus, and that idea alone is just so absurd that you go, oh, my God, we are f***ed. This could be the biggest piece of ever made. Can I say that?
I'll be here.
Oh, okay. But this could be the biggest pile of garbage ever made, and if that's the case, well, you know, we are... we're in trouble. But again, fortunately enough, you know, the performances really come through. And it's because I think you also, and that's also what makes a good film, you know, tense and scary, and is that you need that comic relief a little bit in there to cut some of that tension too sometimes. So, yeah.
You said after the screening that you're hoping that this will be the first part of a trilogy. So this film, is it an adaptation of the first third of the novel, or it's you've just concentrated on certain parts of the book and therefore the sequels will expand on the bits you didn't film?
I guess the simplest way, I mean, we are going ahead with a sequel. As Bruce MacDonald and Tony Burgess like to call it, though, it's more of an equal than it is a sequel.
Sidequel.
Yeah. Or that you could really consider Pontypool more or less as sort of a prequel to what the bigger picture is.
Yeah.
The next film is much bigger, and it is more true to the novel here. This one is sort of designed to really sort of set up the concept of really what's happening, though. And it probably accounts for maybe, you know, a page in the novel itself. It's very minuscule. I remember when I met with Tony Burgess for the first time.
So it's almost like a prequel to the novel, then.
In a sense, yeah. Yeah, and I remember when I met with Tony Burgess for the first time, though, too, asked me, well, have you read the book yet? And I said, you know, trying not to, say, well, I've been really busy, and, you know, I actually haven't had a chance to read it yet, though. And he said, no, good, don't. Just don't read it. So, yeah, it's a very small portion of this book here.
I mean, I thought it was a terrific film, and particularly coming to Fright Fest and seeing films that are so reliant on special effects and makeup, it makes a refreshing change to see a film that actually makes you think, particularly in a relatively familiar genre. You know, was that something that attracted you to the project, that in fact you're not going to have to deal with loads of makeup artists, you're not going to have to get 100 people to dress up as the Living Dead, not that that ever happens in London, you know, and so on?
No, not like it didn't happen this morning. Showed up here at the theater and, you know, 50 zombies outside. It certainly wasn't a conscious decision in terms of budgeting the film with makeup and whatnot. I mean, we had an excellent makeup artist, though, too. And everybody who that worked on this film worked really hard. I mean, the greatest special effect of all, whether, you know, you're watching a big $100 million Hollywood blockbuster or you're watching a small little intimate film like Pontypool, is that the best special effect of all is the imagination. And that's what this film really asks you to do. You know, what you don't see is what you then picture in your own head. And that's truly what's really scary. I mean, my nephew was 11 years old when he saw this film at the Toronto Film Festival last year. And he had been on the set. He met the actors.
Yeah.
He even came in to do some ADR recording for us, you know, some of these extra voices and whatnot. And he saw the film and he was scared to death. I mean, he literally, he cried. He cried and cried, and this was his exorcist. This movie scared the shit out of him. He literally went to school, you know, a couple of weeks later even, after sleeping with the light on for 2 weeks, went to school and was giving a little presentation in class, like, wow, his teacher was asking, you know, you went to the Toronto Film Festival, that's such a big deal, did you see anybody famous or do anything? And please, tell us about your uncle's movie. And he just turned to his teacher and said, can I please talk to the school psychologist? So, of course, I got a call from my sister who was, you know, not so pleased. And I doubt he'll go to the sequel.
Have you agreed to pay his therapy bill for the rest of his life?
Well, now I hope my sister doesn't hear this, so that, because I think you've just given her another idea.
Obviously, with a film that's so preoccupied with sound and speech, I thought that the sound design on the film was excellent. And again, that seems to be something that's very much neglected in a lot of cinema. You have lots of explosions in your 7.1, but it doesn't actually use sound as a palette. That's something that's very much available to filmmakers. You know, was that something that you had to research a lot when it came to making the movie, or you just sort of realized that there are sound designers who work on movies and they probably actually want to work on a film that stretches them a lot more than other projects?
Well, we had, first of all, our sound designer, Steve Monroe, award-winning sound designer, is just top-notch. And I think he really dug deep and really got his hands dirty on this project, though, too, and absolutely loved it. But he was involved. We knew that sound was a big part of this movie. So he was involved in pre-production, though. Like, the sound design of this was very important to us, though. It had to be. it just had to be. Otherwise, you know, the movie wouldn't work though either. So he was involved very early on in terms of just figuring out, okay, what are some logistics here? What are the things that we're hearing? And I can tell you, without a shadow of a doubt, though, the fact that you've picked up on the sound design, as many other people have in the comments that we've received, too, in interviews I've done, but there is a whole whack of other stuff, though, that you're really not even privy to. And if you went back to watch it again, you do hear it all. Because at the same time that all this movie is happening, and it takes place at a radio station, the radio is live 24 hours a day. So, you know, we've got commercials that are in the background and stuff, though, too, and they keep running in music. And, you know, Steve Monroe just did a fantastic job on this, just an absolutely fantastic job, and worked long and hard and made it work. You know, hats off to him for sure.
I don't know how much you want to talk about the sequel, or maybe I should just go and read the book. But is the idea of the creation of whatever this virus is through language explored more in the sequels? Because in this one, it's implied actually it may be Grant Marzi's fault. It may be his opening little monologue about Pontypool and Pantypool. It's such a, you know, it screws with people's heads so much it turns them into maniacs.
Well, Marzi himself is a bit of a nut, a bit of a maniac. But yes, I really can't say too much about the sequel right now for obvious reasons. Yeah. But yes, it certainly does go into it a lot more. And we're hoping that second one, you know, does well. As well, so that we can sort of complete this trilogy, though, with this third one, which is also really quite clever. The second one, the script is just brilliant. Tony Burgess again has, you know, really done a fantastic job. It's a really clever script. I'm very excited for this. It's going to be a great follow-up.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Yes, so am I.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, Pontypool is in cinemas today, and Colin comes out next week. For more information about both films, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com.